So I could introduce you, but I don't even know if I'd do a good job at it. We're here to talk about weed, but would you care to perhaps explain for those who are not familiar, your credentials and why would I bring you here? Why would you be the person who's here to talk about said plant?
Sure. Yeah, I made a show for Vice TV, Viceland, called Weedakit. Previously, it was on YouTube, Vice, and so basically, it was a documentary series about cannabis, about the legalization of cannabis, and it aired, and we reported through it, kind of from about 2014 to about 2017 or 18. So kind of right at the inflection point when states were legalizing more and more, and it went. In the public opinion went from people basically thinking that weed was a bad thing to people being like, oh, maybe it's a good thing. So that's sort of my main credential. I've sort of fallen off the beat, so to speak, over the last 5 years or so. But it's something that keeps kind of, it's something I keep track of, something I keep reading about, something I'm interested in, because I think this year, and from what we'll talk about today and kind of what the Biden administration is signaling, what the DEA and Health and Human Services are doing might mean that federal, maybe not federal prohibition will end, but a drastic change will happen to the way that pot is treated by the federal government. And that has ramifications kind of for all of us, particularly those of us who follow weed or who smoke weed or use it as medicine or make our living in that arena or just are interested. Because I think it also is kind of a really pertinent lens through which to look at criminal justice in the United States, what we punish, what we protect, and what we praise. So that's a stump speech, basically. Like,
Nah,
so I've been doing
do
it for
it.
a while, but I think it's a good lens.
No, man. I mean, let's even back up a little bit because I mean, so Weedakit season one was what year is 20? What?
14 or 15, I
Was it
actually don't know
14? Okay,
offhand.
yeah. So this is coming up on we either a decade or it's about to be a decade. Yeah. So I mean, look, I have to back up. I think I've told this before, but I remember this would have been like 2019. And this was like right after the HBO's contract ended. And so for those of you who are just popping in, maybe you don't know either one of us, Krishna and I both worked at Vice. And so I remember, I don't know if this probably you wouldn't remember, but we're sitting on like outside of some cafe outside of the office. Like we left Vice on South Second, we walked down the street, we went to some coffee shop or something like this. And I think this is my first time like having a conversation with you. We'd like talked in passing, but this is like the first time like talking. It was like, yo, let's leave the building. I forget what we were going to talk about, but like whatever we wanted to talk about, we couldn't talk about it in the building. That's all I remember. So we like leave the building, go to talk at this coffee shop, and we're sitting there. And some dude, as we're talking, I think we just gotten our coffee. Some dude walks up, sees you, and is like, oh my God, thank you so much. Yeah, which is like, he was like, I've seen your stuff. Like, I learned so much from watching. And he was specifically, I think he was talking, because at this point, you had started doing things that were not just about, weed. It was like you were starting to do other things. But I think he was specifically talking about seeing somebody who took this as a subject seriously. I think for him, he was the first, you were the first person that he saw do that. But I think for most people, you were one of the first people who was saying, no, let's take this seriously, not only as a cultural thing, but as a legislative thing, but like let's treat this with the same kind of journalistic rigor that we treat everything else. And you were on the front lines of that, man.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, thank you. I mean, I guess I remember that too. And over the years, people have been very effusive in like the way they're like, yo, this was a good show, not just because I liked it, but because it took a point of view that was oftentimes thought of as like bullshit or derided or just stoner crap and said, hey, let's like actually inhabit the world that people who actually smoke pot, who do it a lot, who do it for reasons that we don't know of. Let's like really take them seriously. I guess empathetically would be the word too, also, because it is like in many cases, like a life or death scenario for people. So basically, anytime there would be like a news story about pot, it would kind of, they would like flip on the Cheech and Chong Dutch angles, do like the puns would come out like in really serious ways. And there was always a remove, I think, that a lot of serious journalists took to pot because it's just fucking pot. You know what I mean? But I think what we did in the show and our approach was to think, yeah, it's just pot, but it ladders into all these like really serious things about what we think how the world works and, you know, who's in power and who's not. So I think we got lucky because that was maybe the only good idea I've ever really had. You know, it's like, hey, let's take this shit seriously.
I don't know about that, man.
But we also, we were also, it was the right time, right place. Cause like, as you said, if it's 2014 that our first digital season came out, that was the first year that was Colorado going legal, which was the first state in the United States to recreationally legalize pot. And that happened on Jan 1, 2014. So that it was an inflection moment. People's opinions were changing. And I'd like to think that we had a large, you know, we played a part in how those opinions were changed. I remember when, you know, we were first making a show, and of course it was, we were making a show for like a youth media company. But a lot of the feedback that I got from listener, from viewers and from people I meet on the street and otherwise is they would watch the show with their families. Because oftentimes it was a way to like communicate about a subject that like it's hard to communicate about. So yeah, I think that that's that. So from an insight point of view, like I've never been the most like the sharpest of cannabis journalists out there. I think there are other people throughout this time who've been doing better hard journalism on this topic. But from a point of view and like how do we approach this? How do we make something that is a niche culture into something that people in the mainstream can think about? That's kind of where I kind of hung my hat.
Yeah. I mean, I think one, I think the first, not the first, not the first episode I saw, but I do remember going back and watching it. Cause I think at some point I was just like, I feel like I'm watching a bunch of other people's stuff. Like I'm watching a bunch of news stuff. Let me try to like watch something different. So I'm just getting different inspirations or whatever. And one of the pieces that you did was, I want to say it was like an undercover cop who'd gone to a high school and entrapped. And this was early days too. It had basically, and I'm going to give kind of a very broad summary of this episode. You should check it out, by the way. I'll post a link in the description or in the chat when I find it. But basically, it's a cop embeds, goes undercover at a high school as it poses as a student and like tries to entrap a bunch of students, but none of them are falling for it because all of them think it's really weird. But he ends up getting one student who's like, this is a kid who's like in partially in a special needs classes, I think also. Is that right?
Yeah, he was, like, I think he was on the spectrum is what I remember from the reporting, yeah.
Yeah, and like he gets somebody who's clearly just a really nice kid, but is more trusting, essentially. That was the only thing he did wrong, is more trusting the other kids, and basically like entraps the kid into buying or selling or something like that. And like ruins the kid's life. And
and
this is something that you wouldn't, you know, maybe your parents wouldn't be familiar with. So this would absolutely be something to watch with your parents, because it's like, yo, this isn't just a bunch of kids sitting around being silly and ha ha ha, let's watch, you know, Harold Kumar go to White Castle or whatever. Like, that's not all this is. This is also, there are layers to this which ruin people's lives for absolutely no reason, because there's these punitive things that are happening, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's a great example of a story that if you think about 10 years down the line, where we are now, it's like, how abusive is it for an adult to pose as a child?
Yeah.
And then
it would never get past that part. Yeah. It'd be like, yo, what are you doing?
But, you know, in the world of, and I think the issue at hand is that the reason pot being illegal for whatever, for the reasons it was legal, oftentimes law enforcement took that as an opportunity to use some, you know, like a substance that is around and out there to get people into trouble, whether that's stop and frisk stuff that was like, you know, was rampant back in the day here in New York, still does happen to some degree if you want to really talk about it. Even the smell of pot as being like the way to start an encounter between police and citizens. So I think like, you know, it was a useful substance to have illegal for law enforcement. I think that's something that's interesting to see kind of roll back.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a people first show. And I think to your point, like this isn't not from my, I didn't do this, but the people at Vice are now re-releasing the episodes that were behind a paywall at Viceland and Hulu onto YouTube.
Yo.
So this is good timing in that sense too, but like, it's been really intriguing to watch some of these episodes that we made years ago and see kind of what they bring up and what has changed and what hasn't, you know, because a lot of the particulars of the laws have changed, but the thematics and the like actual crux of the issues haven't at all.
Okay. So they're dropping some of the ones that were behind the paywall. Okay. If you had to recommend one episode, or do you have a favorite that is now behind the paywall that you would tell, yo, you should watch this one?
Well,
particularly feel something about?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess I'll just, from the universe of stuff that's now out in front of the paywall, there was one we did about the story of Bernard Noble, who was a gentleman from New Orleans who was picked up kind of on a third strike for a simple possession charge. Mm-hmm. And he had two joints worth of pot on him at the time. And he was sentenced ultimately to 13 years in prison. So he served about 7 of those years. And if you trace the story, it kind of shows every kind of way station of the injustice of the war on drugs through his story. He was held in a parish prison way outside of New Orleans that effectively made money from his imprisonment. And so I embedded with those police officers at a different parish sheriff's office. They're very upfront. They're like, yeah, imprisoning pot inmates, big moneymaker for us. And then ultimately what is the good news behind that story he just said that to me. I looked back on that episode because I remember that day being like, okay, we're talking to the sheriff today. So this is going to be an adversarial interview perhaps. And I'm going to have to bring my A game. Yeah. I'm going to have to get him to say, get him to admit to things that I think are true on the surface, but he might try to diffuse and say in other ways.
Yeah.
We had to go to a golf course where the sheriff's department were doing a charity fundraiser. And he's like, oh yeah, just interview me like on the golf course. And I was like, okay, that doesn't look good, maybe, if you want to think of it a certain way, but he did it. And I was so surprised, because as soon as I brought up the money, and we'd done all this research into like how much money they get from the state every day, how much money it actually costs, what that difference is, how many inmates they have. Like, I had the receipts, you know what I'm saying? So I was ready. But he was just like, oh yeah, it's a big moneymaker for us. I'm the big daddy of this parish. I got to take care of everybody. So accepting inmates, that's what we do. So there, I mean, it, and again, this is like,
what?
I think a time before when people, especially when people, like it was a time where it was easier to sort of be real with people about stuff. It was a less spin era. I'm talking 10 years ago, which is crazy.
Yeah. Police We can talk a lot about how police have changed,
which I know you've covered in really cool ways too. Yeah,
we can talk a lot about how police have changed. Yeah. But one thing is, a lot of them have gotten a lot more press savvy.
Oh yeah,
I've had police spokespeople tell me things where I'm just like, I would never do this, but afterwards I can think of a few people offhand where I almost wanted to sit them down and say, look, bro, next time a reporter asks you this question, here's what you don't do. Don't start yelling that the person is lying when they have the facts and figures in front of them. Like, if I say, yo, 75% of this, 25% of that, $5,000 here, $2,000 there, like there's a paper trail. Don't call me a liar. Because anybody can fact check both of us. Like, this doesn't look good. But I think, again, for all, I think the positives that we've said, I think it's been, there is something about law enforcement being honest with you, because often they aren't, and they have no obligation to. You would think that they do, but they actually have no obligation to. They will lie to your face. That is part of the gig, as far as a lot of them are concerned. And so the fact that, because I know exactly what you're talking about, the adversarial interview, you go up and it's like, okay, look, this person is going to try to catch me on a technicality. I'm going to need to make sure. No. I'm not saying this. I'm saying this very specific thing, and I want you to answer this with a yes or no. Are you doing this or are you not doing this? Just tell me yes or no. And then finally get them to, you know, it's accountability. But bro telling you, oh yeah, big money maker. That is incredible, because I don't think that's something that he probably would have had media training at this point, and we would have dodged that. Also wouldn't have done it on a golf course. I haven't seen this one, but I gotta watch this, man.
Yeah, it's out. And like, okay, so the good news, I'll skip to the end, because this is the part that is most meaningful to me, is that in large part due to the media coverage that this case got, and a law that was changed about sentencing in Louisiana, Mr. Noble was released from prison earlier than 13 years. So he served about seven. And now he has his own weed brand alongside Fab Five Freddy. And I think, you know, I saw he was in Spain on Instagram recently, like at a cannabis festival. So it was a pretty raw deal, and he was railroaded pretty hard. But it has a happy ending. It has the kind of happy ending that you think about, okay, cool, when you do like meaningful journalism about things that are clearly on their face unjust, like something might happen. And then the last thing about that, and this is the part of like historical irony, or I don't even know what to call it, is the public information officer for the sheriff's department that we rode along with is now a member of Congress from Louisiana. His name is Clay Higgins. And he is kind of as far right MAGA as you get.
Yeah, I was going to say, heard the I name know before. That yeah. name. Yeah.
yeah.
The pipeline.
Yeah, exactly, man. So like I've tried to get in touch with this office a couple times, be like, hey, let's do a follow up. And I haven't really gotten much from them. But maybe they'll see this and they want to hang out, because as far as doing right or doing well by 10 years, like he's gone from, you know, a small parish sheriff's department in Louisiana to like a really outspoken, you know, a signature voice, let's say, of ascendant wing of his party.
It's an extremely diplomatic way to put it. Yeah. I mean, these are all correct. These are all factually, you used adjectives, which were all true. Yeah, man. No, that is it. And again, it does seem like things, again, have changed, because I think a lot of those things, you know, describing somebody, 13, I was going to say 13 years for two joints worth of weed. Now, I think a lot of people would say that's absolutely ridiculous. Some people would say, no, that's great. Some people would still say that. So I guess we can't say everything has changed. That must have been a wild ride covering that. That's something. But then seeing the results too, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. No, it was a really meaningful story. And it was early on too, because it was the third episode, I think, of the TV season, the first TV season.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
So it's kind of like, oh, what can we do with this kind of show, is what we sort of started to discover through that kind of story. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I think, coverage of weed has totally changed. I mean, it's so different now. People report on the business of it like any other business, which seems, that's a sentence that shouldn't seem strange, but I guess it still is to me. You know what I mean?
Yeah. That's in large part the reason I haven't been so focused on it as a beat, is because it in many ways has moved on to like a very wonky, like almost like economic journalism beat. That like, you know, I can wade into it. I'm certainly no expert in. And so there are places that do such a great job tracking the legislative stuff that's happening everywhere, as well as, you know, the regulatory stuff that continues to happen in states that have it legal and even and are trying to make it legal. Like MJ Biz does a great job. Marijuana Moment is probably one of my faves. They just cover everything and they're fantastic. And then I would even say, like, you know, even at Vice, like, the baton was taken incredibly by people like Keegan Hamilton and Manisha Krishnan, Nate Janowitz down in Mexico City. Like, there was the drugs coverage just was excellent, you know? And so it was cool. It always has been extremely gratifying to just see how that worked, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it's cool that you're able to do, you know, that you can go back to it whenever you want to, but then, I mean, you did so much different stuff. As the anchor, essentially, as the host of the show, but then also making your own stuff. But I want to jump into, okay, so I'm gonna still lean on your knowledge of your old beat, of the beat that you still dip back into sometimes. So what is the current state of weed right now in the States? What's the weed state of the union? Where are we at right now?
All right, here are the numbers. So 24 states in the U.S. have recreational adult use legal. The stat from Pew, I think, is that a majority of Americans live in a state where smoking pot, if you're over 18, or I'm sorry, over 21 in some cases, totally legal. And then I think either 10 or 14 other states have just medical marijuana legal. So some kind of, you can be recommended by your doctor, to get pot for various ailments. But on the federal level, it is still illegal. It is still a Schedule I drug under the Controlled Substances Act, which means that at this point, the federal government does not consider that it has any known medical uses, and that it is dangerous. And so that means, of course, interstate commerce of pot, other than hemp, which has, you know, less than 0.03 or 3% of THC, cannot be transported across state lines. And that's sort of the long and short of it, I guess. So basically, like, you know, from 10 years ago, where there was one state that had it recreationally legal, to now, where there are 24, where less than 50% of people in the country thought that pot should be legal, to now people saying something like 88%, depending on whatever poll you look at, or even 60, even let's say 65%, which is, I think, maybe of young people, perhaps. So it's like there is the sea change is just immeasurable in that sense of just how quickly something changed. I mean, 10 years is a long time, but it's also not a long time.
It's not that long. I mean, yo, I remember one of the first pieces I did at Vice was on the potential, and we were pretty sure it was going to happen, legalization in California.
Yeah.
Prop 64.
In 2016.
Yeah. And I was up there with, I was up with Keegan. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Keegan was there. And we were out in a place that I could not tell you where it was because I'm not supposed to. But also we did so much driving up in some forest that I don't know where we were, somewhere in the Emerald Triangle, interviewing a dude who was totally masked up, like everything, didn't want to reveal his identity. You know how sometimes you're interviewing somebody and like a siren will go by or like planes will go over, you know, it's helicopters. Oh, okay. Let's be quiet because that'll mess with the sound. It messed with the sound, but also he's like, oh shit, that might be the feds. Like,
yeah.
Oh, you're worried about these helicopters for a different reason than I am. and here we are. So yeah, so that's where we are right now. Okay. You know, a bunch of states, recreationally legal, handful more are legal medically. There's still some states where it's totally no go. And then so you can't, I've never tried to do this, so you tell me. So basically interstate commerce, like I couldn't go from California and then sell something in, or nobody could go from California and then sell something in Arizona. Is that the case?
Well, I mean, you can, and okay, people do.
Okay.
But it's technically not like legal.
Got it. Okay.
And unless there's a lot of weight behind you and like you're taking a lot of stuff with you, then it's probably going to be fine. But I wouldn't recommend it. Also because like, and you know, if you really want to be by the book, you can just leave the pot in California and go to a dispensary in Arizona and you'll be fine. Like,
right.
So it's a little silly in some ways because every state that legalizes wants to do it on their own terms. There's they have 100 stakeholders who want to, you know, make sure that it doesn't get in the hands of kids, make sure that the black market isn't like, you know, pot doesn't leak to the black market. Right. But then, so what you have effectively are these like 24 different, regimes that have slightly differing regulations, or sometimes drastically different regulations on how you can advertise, where dispensaries can be, and even gets down to like the local level where certain counties, like in California, a county can say like, we don't want pot here. And then in other states, it's like, you know, municipalities have to say, oh yeah, we approve having dispensaries in our town.
Right.
So the levels of regulation and control are really Byzantine and vary from state to state, from locality to locality. And it's kind of difficult to talk about it all in one breath, other than, you have the people who support it generally are say to themselves and say to the public, we don't want people to go to prison for this anymore. We think this is a social justice issue to some degree. And also, ka-ching, we have like an opportunity to have more money for our state governments, our local governments, et cetera. So it's an interesting dance that, I mean, and I've covered this to some degree for Vice News Tonight over the years. And it's the same, it's sort of a mess, I think is the easiest way of putting it. For the average consumer who's only going to get a little bit of pot every once in a while, fine. Everything works out pretty well. For people who rely on weed for medical reasons, they can get tangled up in certain price situations, in other, you know, insurances don't cover it at all. You can't really get prescribed pot for the most part. You can get recommended by a doctor, but it's not like an actual prescription from the FDA. Weed falls in this kind of nether region of overly regulated to some degree, and then not really even considered real in other ways. So it's tough. It's tough to in one sentence to really give you the state of play.
Got you. So speaking of California, actually, I mean, one of the big arguments, because I remember covering it at Prop 64 when it was about to pass in California, is one of the big arguments, of course, is, yo, this is going to make us so much money. I know that your focus is not the economics, but how has that played out? What are you hearing about that? What do the markets look like in California? What does it look like where you're at? Like, what does it look like?
It's a fair amount. I mean, you know, I think in the market size is in the billions. What different states take home and where they allocate it varies in different ways. And I haven't really been keeping great track of how that has been going. But it's a positive story insofar as taking a legacy industry that has existed for decades and decades and saying, hey, can we make it legit? People try to go legit. People are now paying into a system. And so it's working for some, and for others, it's not working very well. People who want to get in, but in most places, there are only a sentences that states give out, and oftentimes people get left behind. And so that's another story that I've covered here and there. But basically, it's like, you know, if you think about the weed industry prior to legalization, it was a bunch of very creative people working, you know, around the system, creating their own system and getting things done. Like the demand was there beforehand.
Clearly.
Right. Yeah. And so now there's like a bunch of very smart public policymakers and bureaucrats who have designed systems to try to overlay on top of what was already a functioning system to try to, you know, regulate it to some degree, bring in revenue to some other degree, empower certain communities that were harmed by the war on drugs beforehand. But there's successes and failures all along the way. And so I think that's the story to me is like right now in a lot of states that are trying to help people get into the weed industry, the barriers are the barriers that are in front of anyone in a capitalist system. Like, you got money, you're going to win. You don't, like, good luck.
And a lot of those fall along the very similar socioeconomic lines that they always have.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And that's not, and it's interesting. I was talking to the, I suppose she's sort of like the weed czar from Illinois. She is no longer, but when I was doing the piece and I was like, listen, you know, trying to do reparative or restorative justice through cannabis policy and like, you know, basically giving people licenses who are affected by the war on drugs. Are we like, as a state, are you biting off more than you can chew? Like, is this sounds great on paper? Yes, we should definitely be doing this, but are you really just setting up a bunch of people to be disappointed by a new system of the government? Not the criminal justice system, which is clearly worse, but, you know, a system that rewards people with licenses to sell pot that you can't necessarily get, even though you qualify for it. Yeah. And her response was just like, we got to try. You know, it's like, we got a shot at this. And like, you could throw up your hands and say like, well, there's no way the state can do this, or you can give it a go. And so even the failures of that market might still be looked at as success, again, from the point of view of 20 years ago or something like that. But it's pretty wonky stuff we're talking about here. But I think the issue is like, people get really excited about pot being legal. And a lot of times we think the story's over as soon as it becomes legal. But the story kind of continues or just begins a new chapter as it's been legal. And that story is a little different. It's not necessarily like, do you go to prison for 13 years as a result of this? It might be who gets the leg up on creating generational wealth for their families and generations to come. So like, interesting also.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, again, it's the American story, just in another lens. That's it.
Yeah.
We're just repeating the same conversations in a way. I mean, we need to repeat these conversations because we need to have them, period. Yeah. Yeah. So speaking of particular or potential changes or potential good news, so let's get into this. So the catalyst to us talking today is you hit me up and you said, yo, Dexter, Biden is maybe going to do something that might actually be somewhat significant, but I think we need to talk about it. So lay this out for me. What is Biden getting ready to maybe do?
Okay. So as we were saying earlier, marijuana, cannabis is now considered a Schedule I drug on the Controlled Substances Act, which is the piece of federal legislation that basically defines drugs in America, what's illegal, what's not illegal, on a federal level. And so the Biden administration last year directed HHS to take a look and say like, yo, given everything we know about pot now, like, shouldn't we like maybe not consider it as bad as heroin? Like, couldn't we think about it as a different class?
Because that's what a Schedule I drug is, like heroin, yeah. Like coke, like all these other like drugs.
I actually think cocaine is not a Schedule I drug because it has medical uses. Like, you can use it for shit, which they think that pot you can't.
Well, no, I mean, the whole Coca-Cola thing, you know what I mean? Like, hey, this is, it's good for you. But, well, even to get into it, like Schedule I, the definition is that it has no medical use. It's only harmful and thus
and highly addictive
and thus needs to be treated, you know, with the most restrictive policy possible. That's Schedule I.
Yeah.
And we were still there. Okay.
We're still there. That's where it is right now. And so Biden administration's like, hey, let me direct HHS to do a review. And the review also then includes involving the Drug Enforcement Administration, the DEA. And per the rules of the Controlled Substances Act, there's like an 8-point assessment that they have to do to try to change things and do whatever. I'm not quite wonky enough to be able to explain that as well as maybe other people can. But the whole idea is like, yeah, they got to do the bureaucracy to make it happen.
Yeah. Well, let's bring some of this up too. I mean, because I'd love to actually walk through this a little bit. So this. There we go. Okay. This joint right here. So this is this thing you sent me, the American Veterinary Medical Association. So this is from late February, and this walks you through a little bit of, okay, what is the legal landscape? Again, marijuana has been classified as Schedule One since that list was created in 1970. And so, as you said, the Department of Health and Human Services recommended that marijuana be moved to Schedule Three, which... But one of the things that I found interesting in here, I'm trying to find where this was, but this sentence right here, so a little bit further down, so the Biden administration had, as this article explains, in 2022, the Biden administration directed the HHS and the U.S. Attorney General to conduct a review of how marijuana is scheduled under federal law, just like you were explaining, these 8 points, which are, you know, what is the actual potential for abuse? You know, the history of current pattern of use, what risk is there to public health? You know, a list of 8 points, which they would actually use to identify, seriously, how bad is this thing? The assessment that they did leaked. Like, is this why are we even supposed to? This is my question. Are we even supposed to be having this conversation? Are we even supposed to know about this?
Well, I mean, it was a FOIA request that two lawyers put in to HHS. So, and then they put it out to the public. So, a leak might be a strong version of that. It is in the public interest and domain to be able to see what the government is doing. Yeah. However, it is like very technocratic machinations of what government agencies do. They did a 250-page scientific assessment. I didn't read it. but
I feel like it's gonna tell us stuff that mostly we know.
Well, and this is sort of, I mean, you know, this is like anything with public health, like they have to dot their I's and cross their T's on stuff. Yeah. It can't just be like, oh yeah, right, we all know that pot's cool.
I wish that was the document that they just turned it like a totally. One page PDF. Oh yeah, we all know pot's cool. It's fine. It's guys. Cool, bro. Yeah, it's I would fine, it's fine. It's cool, bro. Trust us. Signature.
That's not to say that they didn't get things wrong or that there's like different shades of how people talk about things. Like I'm sure people have talked about it and they should. But then, you know, so the reason I think it's important to talk about now is because this is potentially the last year of the Biden administration. It is an election year. Mm. Vice President Kamala Harris, in an appearance this month, sort of mentioned that the DEA was doing its assessment at the moment and was urging them to go fast. And so that, to me, indicates that, is that Fat Joe? It is, isn't it?
I've just pulled this article up. On Politico, that was the same thing I had. So Politico, the article is titled "Vice President Criticizes Federal Cannabis Restrictions During White House Weed Event," and as I scrolled down, I'm like scrolling down, and I was like,
"Yeah,
is this Fat? What is Fat Joe doing in the White House? Is anybody just like?" The description just casually mentions him, flanked by musician Fat Joe, left, and Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear, right. Vice President Kamala Harris speaks during a roundtable. Like, Fat Joe's just, also, Fat Joe lost some weight.
He looks good, yeah. I believe that he does do a good deal of advocacy for the criminal justice reform, et cetera.
He does.
Which a lot of people I've do, seen which is that. Cool.
I've seen that, but like... when you least expect somebody to pop up, is that Fat Joe? Or am I losing my? No, that's Fat Joe. Fat Joe's sitting right next to Kamala Harris. Yeah.
Well, so my prognostication and predicting things is not a great idea, but maybe it is. I think that it's very likely that before the election this year, it will be rescheduled to Schedule Three because it has clear political benefits. It's like a good headline. Who knows how long it lasts for? Does it actually re-engage younger voters who might be pissed off at the Biden administration for any number of reasons? Is it the kind of thing where you do that cleave where you're just like, well, it shows a difference between who the Biden administration is and who a potential Trump 2 administration would be. Mm-hmm. All of these things. So I think that's kind of where my head is, as like a, you know, it's been 4 years. They haven't done it yet. Maybe this is an interesting election year card to throw. And what are the implications of it? And I think I think is interesting too, is that there is a flank of the Democratic Party who are like, listen, that's not enough. Like, we can't just reschedule it to schedule 3. We should deschedule it entirely, take it off the list of controlled substances. And we can go into what that means, what those things are, because I think there are intricacies that are pretty pretty interesting to think about.
Yeah, well, let's do it, because, okay, so I want to put a pin in the voting part, because I think that's important, and I want to come back to that. So in this article here, we've got Kamala Harris talking. I mean, she uses the word absurd. She says the current Vice President Kamala Harris called the current classification of marijuana under federal law, quote, absurd, during a White House event on Friday. Okay, so what is it that they're potentially going to do? What does it look like is in the actual pipeline? This, you know, the scheduling to schedule 3. What does that mean? What does it not mean?
Okay, so what it'll mean is that there's a couple things I can point to that are pretty interesting, right? So for one, businesses, marijuana businesses, will be able to deduct from their taxes standard business expenses from their federal tax returns, because it's no longer a Schedule I drug. So it's more like a Tylenol or like that sort of drug. Okay. Another thing that's actually, I think, really good is the Department of Veterans Affairs will be able to prescribe or recommend marijuana to veterans. And this is a story I did like a while back about how veterans have been clamoring for this kind of thing for years, primarily because so many veterans, either because of traumatic brain injury or other pain, like chronic pain issues, get addicted to opioids. And so I've talked to a bunch of different veterans rights groups and veterans themselves who are like, listen, pot's a lot better. Like, it doesn't ruin your life. It maybe helps with the pain a little better. And the problem is we can't get it from the VA because it's still federally illegal. We're federally a Schedule I drug. But what it won't do is you can still be punished for having it. Like, it's still like ketamine is another Schedule III drug. Like, there are accepted uses for ketamine. Ketamine can be prescribed. Ketamine can be around. You can have ketamine if you're prescribed it. But if you're like illegally selling like a lot of ketamine, you still could go to prison.
Yeah.
You could catch a federal charge for
happens.
That.
Yeah.
Right.
Don't sell large amounts of ketamine, because you will probably be caught and there will be a problem. Yeah. Don't do that. We don't have
right. So it's not. Yeah. So rescheduling doesn't decriminalize it from a federal level. There's still it's still subject to crimes that are articulated in the CSA and other federal legislation. That's like the big headline of what rescheduling won't do. And then another, there's a couple other things that I think are important, again, from things I've covered. Like, one, so let's say you're in the United States and you have a green card or another kind of visa. If you catch a federal pot charge, you could get deported. It doesn't even have to be a federal charge. It can be a state or local charge. If they refer it up to the feds, like, that is grounds for deportation under the terms of your visa. It's like, that's the rules, guys.
Yeah.
So we did a story about a guy named Kanault who lived in Virginia, lived here since he was a child, young child. And he was busted and deported back to Jamaica, you know, leaving his wife and young child in Virginia to fend for themselves for the most part. He's recently been let back into the country, which is cool. But that's the kind of thing that it won't change, which I think is important. And then another thing like that people don't talk that much about, but like both public housing benefits and student loans that come from the federal government, those can be taken away for marijuana charges. And sometimes they're not, sometimes they are, but this rescheduling will not do anything about that. And a lot of this is
actually...
Take it away
in the sense that you can't get federal housing or you can't get a student loan?
Yeah. I mean, yes. I mean, there are tiers of it. It's not like a black and white issue, but like these are, it's on the table, you know? And so like these sorts of things, so that's not going to, so rescheduling, it won't do anything about that. And you're still... So I think that's where there are pertinent issues why this is important to think about rescheduling versus descheduling. It's super boring to even kind of write it down and say it out loud. But I think that's why descheduling effectively no longer defines marijuana-related offenses as a federal criminal offense. It can still be regulated by like other state laws and stuff like that, but it's different categorically. And so there was a bunch of senators, including, you know, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, the New York senators, California senators, who all wrote the DEA and HHS saying, hey guys, let's go a step further here and actually deschedule it completely. And so that's sort of what's at play, I think, in the next few months, whether, you know, which way the DEA goes on this, how that, you know, how the Biden administration takes a lap on it or not. And, you know, whether it's the kind of thing that means that it'll last too. So I think that's why I wrote you and I was like, huh, this is kind of a conversation I haven't seen being had in many places. And one that merits a bit more, you know, speaking.
Yeah, no, me neither. Okay, hold on. There's so many things to talk about here. So one is that, because there's a lot in there. One of the important things is, as you're mentioning this, you know, that Schedule 3, you know, taking it from Schedule 1 to Schedule 3 is not different from descheduling, different from total decriminalization. You know, that, for example, so it sounds like, if I'm picking up what you're putting down here, it sounds like you're saying, in the same way that if I get prescribed Xanax and I start selling that, I can't do that. Somebody's going to come and say, yo, okay, you got a date behind bars. Let's go. I'm going to have an issue. So similar to that, but I'm also thinking of you saying that, you know, if somebody is here on a visa, they get deported, all these other things, you know, you were also mentioning student loans and stuff like that. I'm thinking that this is going to end up hitting the same people that a lot of laws also hit when there is discretion involved, which is to say that, look, there is a law in Texas where if somebody suspects you are here illegally, they can just grab you, like police, right? Police can just arrest you. It's, you know, stop and frisk, essentially. They're not grabbing people who they suspect, like, I think that there is a European in our midst and we must get rid of this person. I suspect that this Frenchman is here illegally. This isn't happening. You know what I mean? This is going to tend to hit these same people that these laws always hit. And then, of course, things like student loans, you know, the ability to improve yourself or improve your situation. Imagine having that taken away from you for something like this. Again, this is something that already existed. So perhaps this is mitigating what it used to be. But I can see why you're saying that there are advocates who are saying, nah, like, if we're going to do this, let's really do it. Let's go the step further and fully take this thing off. Let's not half do it. So now we're talking about Biden taking a lap, which, let's be real, there are not a whole lot of things that Biden has been able to take a lap on. He's dependent on who you ask. Like, I don't know if I know any true diehard Biden fans. Most of the talk I see about Biden is a mix of really pissed off. I just had I had Evan on not too long, Evan McMorris Santoro, and we talked about the uncommitted vote, you know what I mean, in Michigan. And people are clearly pissed off. So it's a mix of like pissed off and he's all right, somewhere in that in that spectrum. You know what I mean? So do you have any sense of if it's going to lean toward actually taking the recommendation to totally deschedule this thing or go with the Schedule 3, which sounds like kind of in the middle somewhere?
I don't have any reporting to back up any assertion which way it might go or the other. My sense is that the Biden, like, this is probably the sort of issue that doesn't even make his desk. Like, he's not going to pull the trigger on what happens. Like, this is, thus far, Kamala Harris has been the person who kind of has been the it's on her desk, basically.
Right.
And I think that a full descheduling, I don't know what the political downsides are to him for that or to the administration to do that, but kind of it's up to the DEA to make the decision. Like, that's the way the law works. And the DEA is part of the DOJ, which is technically, you know, supposed to be a somewhat independent.
DOJ, Department of Justice.
Yeah, sorry, the Department of Justice.
Yeah.
An independent agency under the executive branch. So, yeah, it's sort of their doing, but I think it's, I mean, to put it bluntly, it's still up to the cops. Like, it's their call.
In a case of Kamala Harris, actually, literally,
an actual cop. Yeah, exactly.
An actual cop.
Well, not a literal cop, but yes.
Not right, literal. Prosecutor. Not literal. Yes.
Yeah. But no, but I mean that because I think that's like incremental steps tends to be what ends up happening. And there are clear benefits, as we've articulated, but there's also some downsides as well. It doesn't go far enough for Drug Policy Alliance and other kind of standard bearers of the legalization movement to be happy about. And I tend to try to take like a, you know, another 20-year view on this and be like, you know, it's a huge win for 10 U.S. senators to write a letter to the DEA saying deschedule completely. Like, that would be unheard of 20 years ago. So yes, the Drug Policy Alliance and other advocacy groups are going to be pissed that this doesn't go far enough. But it is something. And I think that's where, you know, if anyone even thinks about this on election day or in the preceding days and weeks, like, that's kind of where it's at. Plus, it's like, might be the last chance. You know, it might be the last chance before a next administration comes in where I'm sure this won't even be on the table to even talk about. I'm not sure of it. It might be. Who knows? But
yeah, I was going to ask, I mean, do you have any, is there any sense or have you heard any sense that Trump is interested in this also?
The closest I got to that is like for a while, Roger Stone was a proponent of legalizing pot. I remember at some conference I moderated a panel where he was on and it was about pot. And it was at the time, like, he was just like, listen, this is a way, like, I've had a personal experience where it's helped a family member. It should be legal. Let's all come together and make this happen. I think another anecdotal thing that I would say is that those people who I've engaged with over the years who are heavy duty advocates for marijuana reform in one way or the other, it doesn't cleave as neatly to like progressive values as you may think. Like, there are a lot of folks out there who wouldn't describe themselves as progressive or liberal at all, who truly believe that you have to get the government out of the way of pot, who think in those ways as well. So but my sense is that, again, it's not the kind of thing that would really move the needle on the base of the Republican Party in any way. So I don't think they're going to do it. And I think, I can't quite remember if it was like a literal promise of the Biden administration before he came to office. And I should actually look that up. That's a really, I should look that up because if it was, then it's a promise he either keeps or doesn't, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, man. I mean, again, I think the sense that I'm getting from what you're talking about and even the timing of it, and you're saying, you know, it may be the last chance, which it may well be depending on what the next administration is. But it also does seem like it is leading up to an election. I think the Biden administration is looking for ways to distinguish themselves from the opposition, or at the very least, you know, partially remind people they're still there, but also, hey, we're still doing things you want us to do. Voters, please do this. And he's not doing great with younger voters, and younger voters in younger Americans in particular are the ones that tend to be pretty, I'm going to say, displeased, say, with handling of Palestine right now. And I think we've probably seen some policy changes because of the voicing of that dissatisfaction, I'm going to say, very diplomatically, dissatisfaction with the policy. And so, you know, we're seeing some movement. But, I don't want to be cynical to say, oh, this is a ploy for votes. I don't want to do that because I don't want to put it into that box necessarily, because this is something that could actually be relevant for a lot of people. You know what I mean? Like, less penalties, that sort of thing. I mean, that is a win. The question is, does it stop there? Could we go further? And I think, and it sounds like that's what a lot of advocates are saying. Do you have any sense of if it does, say, if Biden did or Kamala Harris did start pushing for actual, totally descheduling, is that something that is going to get some of these advocates to actually more vocally come out and say, yo, we need to get Biden in, you know, we keep Biden in office so that we can actually make this happen?
I haven't heard anyone. I mean, the thing is, like, the polling on this is also equally not instructive to try to understand voter. Like, there's no single issue pot voters anymore. Maybe there are, but then on a federal level, it doesn't really seem to be the case. And I think if you look at the stakes of, like, what pot means, which can be life and death, versus other large policy decisions that are on the table at the moment, it can often be like, all right, pot's a little more minimal as far as big issues. But I mean, that said, I think, like, it aligns to a certain set of progressive ideas, which are the war on drugs was racist. Institutional racism exists. We need to call it out where it is and fix it as best we can with the government that we have. And I think so whether or not it's like a distinguishing element to someone as to whether they will go out and actually vote or ask their friends to vote or take their, you know, friends and families to the polls or whatnot, it does remind a person that, hey, the government can do things that are obviously correct. You know, and I think that, like, we don't know how powerful that it's possible. Right. So there's that at hand. And I also, I mean, you know, a couple of years ago, I talked to Governor Phil Murphy of New Jersey as they were about to roll out legal pot there, recreational legal pot. And, you know, when you talk to, I mean, he's a progressive Democratic governor, but kind of not as progressive as some others. The mainline party line on this is, like, it does two things at once, you know, just like it gives revenue for the state and it's a social justice issue at heart. And so I think this is the kind of thing that, you know, very easily can be looked at as a political win and the right thing to do. And I think you don't have to go the furthest that the advocates and activists want to be able to claim that win. And so I think that's basically where it stands.
Which just sounded like a Schedule 3 and not descheduling. It sounds like that's...
I'm not going to put odds on it or anything like that. But yeah, that's where I would see it. And of course, and I think it's because the DEA is kind of the determinant agency at the moment. And so I think they'll make a decision that's more aligned with DEA policy.
Yeah, a more conservative policy. Yeah, not surprising.
Which is funny because, like, the idea, I think, ultimately behind the conservatism in all of these elements is to keep pot out of the hands of kids and to make sure it's not more of a harm. It causes more harm by becoming legalized. And I think what most of the data that comes out of the states as they report it is that net net, it's a harm reduction strategy of making pot more and more legal, which is to say fewer people go to prison, which is to say fewer kids actually get access to it in the way that they used to. And I mean, it's not, like, as cool, I guess, as it was beforehand. That's part of it.
Yeah. you just go to this Apple store looking place and pick some up. It's like, okay, this, yeah.
Yeah. So I think, like, those are the two things that I think policymakers oftentimes really keep in mind. On the other hand, I'm not sure if we can get into all of this, but, like, the situation on the ground in a place like New York is so interesting and bizarre because there are so many, like any bodega you go to basically will have pot for sale. Like any, yeah, like if you go into Midtown.
Yeah, here we go.
It's just like, it's just immense what has happened. It's like the genie is out of the bottle in this like very bizarre way that I think a lot of people are scratching their heads saying like, wait a second, is this exactly what we were looking to do here? And I'm kind of like, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah. So the headline on this is New York Mag. The weed bodegas have no fear. It's illegal to sell without a license. Not that this has stopped 1,500 stores and counting. So yeah, what's it like over there?
Well, so I'll give an example. I was like in Midtown in like the theater district like last week. And on 9th Avenue between like 50th and 49th, there was three dispensaries on the west side of the street. Which is like, I don't know how many of them actually were licensed. They're trying to get that kind of folks who are in town from around the country. But it's a bizarro land when you think about it. And a lot of the stuff that is being sold there isn't coming from New York. Like you can tell from the packaging that it's been packaged for a place like California. So yes, I think like the reality on the ground is that there are these designed systems for making pot regulated and legal, but people are always going to find a way to, I mean, like there's structural reasons for that, like how much pot is grown in California versus how much can actually be sold. But there's also just the spirit of pot is that it's just going to find a way to like be creative and weird. Like that's just how it always has been.
That makes sense. Why? Maybe this is my last question. And this is something that you mentioned earlier. When you brought this up to me, I thought, why haven't I heard of this? And I've looked around and I've read around a little bit and I'm not seeing a lot of people talking about this. What's going on? Are you just ahead of the curve? That's a good explanation, but.
Yeah, I actually haven't really considered that question. I think that there might be larger fish to fry generally. Like we're talking about like the future of our democracy. We're talking about, I think that's what I would say. The big
there's
moves,
bigger things happening in news right now.
And in the world. Wise. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, exactly. And during a lot of the stuff, well, I'll put it this way. Like, the big news of pot, like if it gets federally descheduled or rescheduled, it's still not going to be as big as when California went legal. Like the first dominoes to fall were like the biggest and shook people the most. And now it's a kind of bureaucratic incrementalism that we see happening. Public opinion has already changed to the most, right, for the most part. Like the big things have already happened. So right. I think like, while this is a big story for people who are super paying attention to this stuff, for the average person who's paying attention to news or not, it doesn't mean a whole lot as their lives are changing these days. So I think that's effectively why. I think when it does happen, if it does happen in the next few months, like it will be a 2-day or 3-day news story. And we'll be like, okay, cool. Moving on, you know, like.
Wow. I mean, just having been in the business for a little bit, the news business, not the weed business, for any feds watching, because not descheduled yet. That sounds about right. I think that's a good take on it. I mean, I think what you've laid out here is a very reliable prediction. I think it's very predictable that this will, like you said, in the next few months, it's going to come up. It's going to be announced. I think the Biden administration is going to hope for some fanfare about it. I think it's also very reasonable to say, yeah, it's going to be a couple of days. People are going to talk about it. There's going to be a couple explainers. Vox is going to make a nice explainer about it. You know, I mean, there's going to be some nice TikToks that lay everything out for you, explain what we just talked about, what's, you know, Schedule 3, what's descheduling. And then we'll go back to whatever else we were doing before. That sounds about right.
Yeah. And to a degree, it speaks to the like depressing state of our politics, which is like there's bigger things to talk about because so much of our politics is just people fucking lying about everything all the time. And so this pot is finally like in a rational state of public policy, whereas it wasn't for decades and decades, to in contrast to everything else that's going on.
Yeah. And one question in chat, which I think I know the answer to this one. The conversation about descheduling or, you know, moving to Schedule 3, whatever the case may be, that would not affect those people who were incarcerated over charges that have been happening. This isn't going to be retroactive. Like if you were caught up on charges, or is that part of the discussion?
Well, no, but I think the Biden administration already has taken some steps for the people who have had, who are in prison for federal cannabis crimes, to let people out of prison and to expunge records. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of that has happened, they've said that it is going to happen. So I don't, so to the question is like, no, it won't actually affect people like that. But another thing to think about is that there aren't that many federal inmates who are in prison for small amounts of marijuana. A lot of it is like very heavy trafficking. Mm-hmm. And we tried to do this data journalism project for years now, like how many actual people. And it's a much harder lift than you might think. There's a place that's doing a good job from like a public policy / nonprofit world called the Last Prisoner Project. They try to keep track of these things pretty stringently, but it's a big gumshoe reporting project where you actually call every jurisdiction and be like, so who's in your prisons and why?
Right. Cause they don't make the data easy to collect or easy to aggregate. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've dealt with stuff like that before. Yeah. Just make this stuff easier. Like, what are you hiding? Explain what you're doing. I'm going to ask you some questions, but yeah, man. But yeah. So thank you so much for helping to break this down, man.
Thanks for having me on, man. It was fun to talk about it. I'm a little rusty, I think, ultimately, but I found some of those grooves. You feel like
wait, rusty how? What do you mean?
I don't know. I don't remember all the things that I used to be able to remember about this stuff. But
well, you're not rattling off the figures all the time. So
yeah, that's right.
You I mean, you were like, I've talked to this person. I talked to this person. You could have fooled me, man.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
You did. But anyway, man, thank you for coming through. And please, anytime you are, can we have you back again at some point?
Anytime you want. This is so fun. It was just fun to talk.
Hell yeah. Hell yeah. Dude, anytime, come back through. If you can talk about weed, you can talk about whatever you want. If there's anything you got a take on, got some insight on, I would love to have you on. I know the people listening and watching would love to have you on. So thank you so much, man.
All right, Dex. Take care.
Appreciate you. Easy.